Good day. Today is Wednesday, 18th February 2026. And let me remind you again, before I proceed with this programme, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, before I proceed with the discussion of the extraordinary and chaotic negotiations that have been taking place in Geneva, let me begin with what I think is by far the most important event of all, which is exercises that were conducted by the IRGC, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, in the Straits of Hormuz. Now, as I understand it, the IRGC actually closed the Straits of Hormuz for a few hours, saying that they were conducting live fire exercises there. Now, I understand this is the first time that Iran has done this in many, many years, perhaps even decades. And of course, if you think that this is not connected with the enormous troop movements and fleet movements that the United States is conducting close to Iran's territory, the constant deployment of more and more aircraft, more and more ships, more and more carriers, two US Navy carriers now definitely intended to be deployed in the Arabian Sea. Well, if you think that the two events are unconnected, then I have obviously a bridge to sell you. I don't believe, sophisticated people as all of you are, that any one of you thinks that these two events are not connected. Anyway, suffice to say that the fact that the IRGC is acting in this way is the strongest possible sign that the Iranians now expect war to happen and are busy preparing for that fact. And we must understand the diplomatic exchanges that took place in Geneva yesterday and the day before, yesterday and today, as being basically, as far as the Iranians are concerned, a diplomatic sideshow. We have had more defiant statements from the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. He has spoken about how Iran will absorb whatever blow it is that the United States is preparing. And I continue to receive constant information about increasing support for Iran from both China and Russia now. The Chinese, in particular, seem to be heavily involved in Iran at this time. I gather that Chinese military people are currently in Iran. Russians are also there, but the Chinese are absolutely there in great number. And there are all kinds of rumours and reports and speculations that Iran is receiving important military aid from China and from Russia as it prepares for the conflict with the United States. And on that, the provision of intelligence continues. Both the Chinese and the Russians are providing Iran with intelligence assistance. And in particular, it seems that both of these countries are now helping Iran to keep track of the various cells planted inside Iran by Israel and the United States, cells which are supposed to be activated. These are resistance fighters, sabotage figures, dissidents, that kind of thing, in the event of an attempted attack by the United States. The cells being used to provoke protest and chaos within Iran itself. I'm also getting reports that both China and Russia are now extending to Iran more economic support. The extent of this, again, is difficult for me to gauge. I've been looking at the situation with the Iranian currency, the rial. I get the sense that it is continuing to weaken, but not perhaps at the kind of extraordinary pace that it was weakening just before the end of the year. The collapse of the rial at that time, having been the event which provoked the protests. And of course, we now know that both the protests and the collapse of the rial were to a great extent orchestrated, or at least assisted, by the United States and by its various agencies. Again, it's very difficult for an outsider to get a sense of what is happening in Iran, in the situation of the economy, but maybe, just possibly, we are looking at some level of economic stabilization, in which case assistance from China and Russia probably are, especially China, probably are playing some role. It would be helpful if anybody who has information about this could convey it on the threads. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the situation. The key event, the most striking event, is this exercise involving the potential closure of the Straits of Hormuz. And, well, that looks to me very much, as I said, like a dress rehearsal for an operation that the Iranians are planning to take in the event that there is a conflict between Iran and the United States. Now, there is some other things happening which are very interesting and may also be pointing to a growing crisis, a gathering crisis. Now, over the last few weeks, there has been a major jump. Well, there has been a jump. I don't know if it's a major jump, but there has been a jump in Russian oil exports. And Russia has been increasing the amount of oil it's been exporting, certainly as compared with the rather reduced level of exports which we saw last year, at the end of last year. And interestingly, movements of tankers show that this oil, this Russian oil, which, as I said, is now being exported in bigger numbers, is heading towards China, not towards India. Now, there have been some suggestions that this is connected to Prime Minister Modi's supposed agreement with Donald Trump to reduce purchases of Russian oil, something which, by the way, the Indians have never themselves confirmed. Now, this is possible, and I'm not going to say that that is not the case. It is certainly possible. But I understand that discussions about increased oil deliveries from Russia to China have actually been taking place for some time, and that these go back to January. And it could be, and I'm simply floating this possibility now, that the reason for this surge in exports, Russian oil exports to China, is that China is stockpiling oil to the extent that it can, in light of the strong possibility that at some point over the next few weeks or months, there could be a closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Now, in saying all of this, China does have significant stockpiles of oil. It is, by the way, itself an oil import producer, though, of course, it still imports the greater amount of its oil. And it's also true that the oil that Iran imports via the Straits of Hormuz is light Arabian crude. I understand that Iranian oil is similar to light Iranian crude, Arabian crude. But anyway, it is a different type of oil from the rather heavier oil that Russia produces, which is indeed heavier, though not as heavy, by the way, much less heavy than Venezuelan oil is. Well, I'm not going to pretend again to be a great expert about these matters. I suspect that provided the Chinese do continue to receive oil, their refineries can still work with it and would still be in a position to refine the oil if it came from Russia, and that such oil supplied by Russia to China would, at least to a certain extent, reduce the problems that a cut-off from the Straits of Hormuz might cause. It's also, I am sure, the case that China has stockpiles of oil, which it has built up over many years, probably, to cover for exactly this kind of eventuality. After all, it is hardly a secret that the United States has been talking about an oil blockade of China since at least the Obama era. Just say. Anyway, you should perhaps take this a little more as being a little bit more speculative from me than exact facts, but it does seem to me that these sudden transfers, this sudden jump in Russian oil exports to China could be consistent with China anticipating a crisis between Iran and the United States, a conflict between Iran and the United States, requiring China to secure its stockpile of oil, to build up its stockpile of oil ahead of a possible closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Now, on this, I'm still getting lots of reports about the scale of the American build-up that is taking place, and it is indeed great. I understand that the warships that are being deployed around Iran have something like 600 Tomahawk missiles between them. Now, that may sound like an awful lot, but in my opinion, it isn't. Not for a country the size of Iran, and not in light of what I have seen Ukraine absorb in terms of the much more powerful Russian missiles that the Russians have been launching at Ukraine. So 600 Tomahawk missiles will be a very, very powerful blow in the first couple of days, but then I suspect the effect will fade, and I wonder how long an operation can be sustained, especially if there are problems of reloading warships. I presume that in order to reload Tomahawk missiles on warships, the warships have to return to port, and I understand that the nearest port is perhaps Bahrain, which is well within reach of Iranian missiles. And of course, if the Straits of Hormuz are closed, then of course the US Navy can't reach Bahrain. They might have to go far further afield to places like Diego Garcia and places like that. But again, I don't want to speculate too much about matters that are well beyond my knowledge. Anyway, there have been some other rather strange pieces of information. It seems, for example, at least there are stories going round, that the original intention was that the second carrier that would be deployed to the Arabian Sea was not going to be the Gerald Ford at all. It was going to be the George H.W. Bush, which was supposed to leave the United States, leave from California, and that was going to be the carrier that was going to be deployed to the Arabian Sea. Just a few days ago, I was reading reports that three carriers were going to be deployed altogether, and that the George H.W. Bush, as well as the Gerald Ford, were heading to the Arabian Sea, making, together with the USS Abraham Lincoln, three aircraft carriers and their escorts, escort groups in total. But it seems that the George H.W. Bush is not going to be sent at all. It's said that there are some undisclosed problems, that there are some maintenance issues, maybe. I am not going to speculate about this. But the Gerald Ford, which is America's latest, most modern carrier, but which has already been in active service, has been on patrol now for some time, first in the Mediterranean, and now, and more recently, in the Caribbean, has had to be diverted from its tasks in the Caribbean. Not because that was part of the original plan, but because it's had to take the place of the George H.W. Bush. Now, if all of this is true, it does suggest that there are more problems with the American Navy than perhaps we know. That maybe ships are old, that they're not always in full states of repair. That the United States Navy, big and powerful as it is having to juggle warships. And, well, all of this might indeed be a problem. Again, I don't want to speculate too much about matters that I know less about and which I am emphatically not an expert about. But I have read those reports and they do seem to be plausible, and I do find them interesting. Now, having said all of this, let's turn now to the events in Geneva. And as I discussed in my programme yesterday, we have had the extraordinary situation, indeed the utterly bizarre, unprecedented situation of the same group of American negotiators, basically Witkoff and Kushner, neither of whom are trained diplomats or professional diplomats, neither of whom have a vast depth of experience in negotiations at this level. One of whom, Jared Kushner, is not, properly speaking, even a member of the American government. Anyway, these two negotiators going from one top level negotiation, the one with the Iranians, to the other top level negotiation, the one with the Ukrainians and with the Russians. And I said that this is extraordinary, that I've never heard of anything like that before. And, well, I then read an article yesterday in Reuters in which it was quite clear that I'm far from being the only person who finds this situation as completely bizarre. Some of the participants in the talks are furious as well. There was comments from all sorts of people talking to Reuters saying that this is a completely dilettante-ish approach to diplomacy. That, again, Witkoff and Kushner are completely out of their depth dealing with such formidable and skilled operators as Araqchi and Medinsky and Galuzin, and that the Iranians, there was one person who spoke to Reuters who was described as being close to the Iranian negotiators, who conveyed to Reuters the Iranians' anger and their belief that this weird way in which the negotiations were being conducted was a sign that the United States really isn't taking the negotiations, certainly not the negotiations with Iran, that it isn't taking those negotiations seriously. And I have to say that I agree. If there was a real wish, a real concern in the United States to avoid war with Iran in the Middle East, surely the negotiators would be focused on talking to the Iranians and would not want to distract themselves by also having the Ukrainians and the Russians there as well. Anyway, it's not just the Iranians who are angry with the negotiations that took place in Geneva. The Russians, as always, retain a disciplined silence after these talks. The chief Russian negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, has spoken to the Russian media. He said that the negotiations in Geneva were difficult but businesslike. Now, in deciphering that diplomatic language, as far as I can see, what that means is that they were businesslike in the sense that the Russians, at least, put forward their views clearly and without equivocation. And when the Russians say that the negotiations were difficult, it's a good sign that no substantive progress of any kind was made. But anyway, that is what Medinsky said. He said that despite the negotiations having been difficult, there would be another round of the negotiations soon, which of course suits the Russians very well, because from the Russian point of view, it is they who have wanted to conduct the negotiations in this format with the Ukrainians. It is the Ukrainians, in fact, people always overlook, who have twice pulled out of negotiations with the Russians before. On the first occasion in April 2022 in Istanbul, after which, by the way, in September or October of 2022, Zelensky then issued a decree which prohibited negotiations with the Russians entirely until the moment came when the Russians completely withdrew from all Ukrainian territory as it existed on the 1st of January 2014. In other words, until the Russians withdrew from Crimea as well. And of course, it was the Ukrainians also who withdrew from the Istanbul talks that took place last year, as they themselves announced in the autumn of last year that they were not going to continue with those talks any longer because the Russians were refusing to talk about a ceasefire. So Medinsky telling the Ukrainians, well, we've got you where we want you. We've got you where we want you. We want you to be there in the room listening to my lectures and to my forceful demands. And this is keeping you busy and active, and it's creating divisions between you. I will come to that in a moment. Anyway, it's not surprising, therefore, that Medinsky says, well, why don't we do soon enough the same thing all over again? So it's understandable, maybe, that Medinsky would say that. But we've had comments, series of comments, that all ultimately derive from the Ukrainians. And these give a completely different picture. So firstly, The Economist yesterday, British magazine, fervidly pro-Ukrainian, deeply hostile to President Putin, hostile to Russia altogether, I would say. Anyway, The Economist says that there is a split in the Ukrainian negotiating team. In fact, it's not at all clear any longer who actually leads the Ukrainian negotiating team. There are two powerful personalities, if that's the right word, on the negotiating team. One is Rustem Umerov, who is connected to Andrei Yermak, and who is personally deeply loyal, as far as I can tell, to Vladimir Zelensky. Now, he is the official chief negotiator on the Ukrainian side. So that is one person. The other is Kirilo Budanov, former head of Ukrainian military intelligence, an increasingly independent voice in Ukrainian politics, someone who has now become Zelensky's chief of staff. And he also is there in the negotiating team as well. And according to The Economist, these two individuals are taking completely different approaches to the negotiations. Budanov wants to do a deal with the Russians as quickly as possible. Starting from the spring of last year, he was saying that the war is going badly, that from mid-summer of 2025, the situation for Ukraine was going to deteriorate rapidly. About that, by the way, he has been proved absolutely correct, and who has been indicating for quite a long time that it is impossible for Ukraine to win the war, and that there is a real possibility that it won't just lose the war, but lose in such a way as to put the entire survival of Ukraine as a state in question. So Budanov, very close to the Americans, heavily involved with the CIA, according to many reports. Budanov, who is also acquainted with Dan Driscoll, one of the US negotiators who was also present in Geneva. Budanov, who in fact brought Dan Driscoll, enabled Dan Driscoll to gatecrash a private meeting which Budanov was having in Abu Dhabi with Russian intelligence officers, something which the Russians were not informed about in advance and which they were very unhappy about. Anyway, Budanov wants to agree some kind of deal with the Russians as soon as possible, and he is prepared to make major concessions to achieve it. Apparently, according to rumour, these concessions might extend to a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. And that, according to rumour, is, and also according to The Economist, is Budanov's approach. By contrast, Umerov, loyal to Zelensky and to Yermak, takes the absolutely diametrically opposite approach. He doesn't want to negotiate on any fundamental concessions with the Russians. He certainly is not going to countenance any withdrawal from Donbass. He insists on sticking to what has been the official Ukrainian negotiating track ever since Yermak and Zelensky very reluctantly agreed to an American demand for a ceasefire on the existing conflict line in March of last year. Their position is that they will agree to such a ceasefire on the conflict line and nothing else. They will not agree to recognize any territory that the Russians occupy as Russian. They will make no internal changes to Ukraine. They insist that they must have as big an army as Ukraine wants and as heavily equipped as it wants. And they want an Article 5 type security guarantee from the United States. All positions that are completely unacceptable to the Russians. So apparently, according to The Economist, and it is very consistent with what we have been hearing from Budanov and Zelensky for over a year now, there is a sharp division within the Ukrainian negotiating team. And it looks as if, in effect, Ukraine has two different chief negotiators in conflict with each other. And this might, by the way, explain why, apparently, over the course of the Geneva meeting, the meeting itself broke up. And apparently, two completely different chief negotiators from Ukraine were running different parts of the discussion. So one part of the discussion took place between Medinsky and Umerov, and it concerned political matters, territory, Ukraine's non-aligned neutral status, rights for Russians, all the big fundamental things. And then there was the military and security and intelligence dialogue between Budanov and Admiral Kostyakov of the General Staff. And that was about entirely different things, buffer zones, control mechanisms, but perhaps the dirty war as well, those things too. So when people say that the talks on the first day lasted for 6 hours, this is something of a misunderstanding, because apparently there were two separate meetings. One meeting in which the Russian group was headed by Medinsky and the Ukrainian group by Umerov, and a second meeting which was headed by Kostyakov on the Russian side and Budanov. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss this more deeply, but again, one can see why Medinsky, who is heading what is a united team, acting under Putin's instructions and with his supervision, is quite happy to allow these negotiations to continue, because they are exposing gaps and differences and, if you like, even splits on the Ukrainian side. But anyway, that was one piece of information. And again, it must originate from Ukrainian sources. Someone, perhaps Budanov and his people, have been talking to The Economist about the divisions in Ukraine. And then there is more information, this time from Barak Ravid, who is a US journalist working for Axios, a very hardline journalist indeed, by the way, somebody who strongly supports, well, I would regard him basically as a neocon to his fingertips. But that is not to say that he's not a very well-informed figure. And he reports that the meeting in Geneva between the Ukrainians and the Russians was tense, that it didn't go particularly well, that everything hit deadlock, that the talks in effect stalled, and that the reason they stalled was because of Medinsky's approach, the extremely hard line that Medinsky took during the negotiations. And already you're getting all kinds of comments in the West that it was precisely because Medinsky is such a tough, hardline figure that Putin appointed him to head the negotiating team in the first place. Now, about few individuals in this conflict does one hear such diametrically opposed opinions about than Medinsky. People like John Helmer, for example, regard Medinsky as a weak negotiator, somebody who's very much in Putin's pocket, who basically just does as he's told, and whose job it is to concede on all major Russian positions to the West, to the United States. And, well, that's Helmer, who has a very negative view of Medinsky as well. But you also see others, people like Ben Aris, other commentators like Ben Aris, and Anatol Levin, who also think that the Russians are going into these negotiations in some great mood to compromise, that they're prepared to make massive concessions in order to achieve peace, that from their point of view, the situation in their economy is bad, that they're suffering enormous losses on the battlefronts, and that Medinsky has been sent to Geneva to cut a deal. So that's one view of Medinsky. The other view of Medinsky is the one that the Ukrainians hold and which others who have encountered him from the West hold also, that he is an extremely tough, hardline character, even what the British like to call a bruiser, that he is completely on top of every detail in the negotiations, and that he doesn't give an inch. That far from being this person who's been sent to cut a deal, he is there to make sure that Russian interests are defended and defended vigorously, and to come to an agreement that is in Russia's interests. Now, I will express my own view here about Medinsky, which is that I do think overall that he is actually a pretty tough, hardline figure. I don't think he's any kind of soft person. I don't think the Russians would ever send a person like that to head their negotiating team. But he's not an impossible negotiator to work with. After all, he did negotiate with the Ukrainians the April 2022 Istanbul Agreement, though he did so undoubtedly with Putin's full backing and support. So he's somebody who will conduct negotiations in good faith, but that ultimately depends on the other side being prepared to negotiate in the first place and to recognise and acknowledge that the Russians have demands and that these demands do need to be taken seriously and there need to be serious negotiations over them. So anyway, that is my view of Medinsky. Whatever, according to Barak Ravid, the negotiation didn't go well. And Zelensky also, by the way, spoke to Barak Ravid. He was probably the source, Barak's source, for what actually happened in Geneva. And I got the sense that Zelensky was furious. He was furious because he said the Americans are putting pressure on Ukraine to make concessions, to agree, obviously, to withdraw from Donbass. Zelensky said that this is unfair. Now, again, I find that, and I have to say, I find that very curious, even extraordinary, actually. Since when has war or negotiations which take place in a context of war ever been fair? Just say. Anyway, Zelensky thinks it's very unfair. He thinks that the Americans should not be putting pressure on him and on the Ukrainians. They should be putting pressure on the Russians. it doesn't seem to have registered with him that the Americans have been trying to put pressure on the Russians for 4 years, and arguably even further, going back to the original 2014 crisis. And none of that pressure has produced any result, just saying. But anyway, he thinks there should be more pressure from the US towards Russia. He obviously wants Ukraine to receive more money and more weapons from the West, including from the United States. He says that whilst the Ukrainian people might accept a ceasefire on the existing conflict line, they will never accept any handing over, any additional handing over of territory. Whether Zelensky really speaks for the Ukrainian people on this question, well, I have my doubts, but anyway, that is what he said. And overall, and in its totality, Zelensky not only made clear that he's not prepared to make any substantive concessions in the negotiations at all, but that he massively resents the fact that there has been negotiations taking place at all with the Russians. He isn't comfortable negotiating with the Russians. He far prefers the situation as it existed in Joe Biden's time, when there were no negotiations, just an unending stream of money and weapons coming in his direction. And certainly he's not prepared to make any significant concessions to the Russians whatsoever. Now, it's been suggested that if you want to see proof that the Americans are putting pressure on the Ukrainians, then the layout of the room in the Intercontinental Hotel illustrates that fact. In the meetings in Abu Dhabi, the Americans were in the centre, the Ukrainians sat to the right of the Americans, and the Ukrainians and the Russians sat on the left. This time it was the other way round. This time it was the Russians who were sitting on the right and the Ukrainians who were sitting on the left. And supposedly sitting on the right means that the Americans are more on your side. So in Geneva, they were more on the side of the Russians, whereas in Abu Dhabi, they were more on the side of the Ukrainians. I think that this is true in other negotiations, more structured negotiations. It was true, for example, during the Paris negotiations between the North Vietnamese and the Americans in the 60s and 70s. Given the extraordinary chaos in which these negotiations have been conducted, I don't think one could say that in this case. I think more likely the layout of the places was something that the Swiss did without consulting with anybody, just saying. That's my own view. But anyway, Zelensky's very annoyed, very angry about all of this, and he's not prepared to make any significant concessions at all. So anyway, we had this meeting in Geneva. It's clear from what the Russians and the Ukrainians are saying that there was no significant substantive progress over the course of it. I mentioned Ben Aris and Anatol Levin. Both of them appear to believe that the war is now coming to an end and that the negotiations will shortly bear fruit. I am unable myself to see what the basis for this optimism is, actually. It was the case back in August when Putin and Trump met in Anchorage that we seemed briefly to be close to a diplomatic breakthrough. But I don't get the sense that that is the case anymore. On the contrary, if anything, the gulf between the two sides, as far as I could see, the Russians and the Ukrainians, is actually getting wider. Some people on the Ukrainian side, Budanov, can obviously see that the writing is on the wall. People like Vitali Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, agree with him. But the dominant faction in Kiev, Zelensky's, Yermak's, and Umerov's, take a completely different view. And they did something also, this dominant faction, which I can't help but feel was calculated, in effect, to throw a monkey wrench into the negotiations, which is that apparently, without consulting the Americans and certainly without telling the Russians, Zelensky, on the eve of the negotiations, phoned all his European friends and, as it is politely put, invited his European friends to come and participate in the negotiations in Geneva. This despite the fact that the Americans and the Russians had agreed that the only parties that would participate in the negotiations would be Russia, the United States, and Ukraine. And sure enough, the national security advisors of four European countries, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy, all showed up in Geneva. And it was fairly clear that what they were trying to do was to gate crash the talks. Apparently, they wanted to join the talks, if not on the first day, then at least on the second, so that they could say that they were actually in the room. And Zelensky wanted them there, because even if the Americans have at times given the impression that they want the negotiations to proceed and to succeed, and for the Ukrainians to make concessions to the Russians to enable that to happen, the Europeans, as I've discussed in programme after programme, have been playing a spoiling role. They don't want any kind of negotiations, any kind of settlement, any kind of agreement of the conflict in Ukraine that compromises on any issue. Ukraine must be able, at the end of the war, to join both NATO and the EU. It must be allowed to have as big an army as it wishes, and there must be, under no circumstances, any further cession of territory to Russia, and all territory that Russia controls must continue to be recognised and considered Ukrainian. Demands, which of course the Russians will never accept. So anyway, these national security advisers, I saw pictures in the hotel room, in the hotel, the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva, of Keir Starmer's national security advisor, Jonathan Powell, prowling the rooms and the corridors. Anyway, these national security advisers all turned up in Geneva on the evening of yesterday. And, well, in the event the Americans and the Russians didn't allow them to join the talks today, I suspect that had they been there, the Russians would have walked out. But regardless of that, they did apparently have meetings with the Ukrainians and the Americans yesterday. And unbelievably, there is even video footage, video taken, I suspect, by the hotel's security cameras, in which you see Jonathan Powell talking anxiously to Steve Witkoff. Now, of course, it could be that these national security advisers We're also there to talk about Iran and the conflict there. But they were invited to come by Zelensky, and I presume that they were actually there to discuss Ukraine. So anyway, a circus. I really cannot describe it in any other way. A divided Ukrainian delegation, an American delegation which is only half engaged, if it was properly engaged at all, and the Russians led by a notorious bruiser, Vladimir Medinsky, who made his views absolutely clear, and he was not in any mood to give an inch. The Ukrainians, on Ukrainian social media, they've been saying that this whole thing was just a pointless, empty performance put on for the benefit of one individual, who is Donald Trump. Remarkably, Deutsche Welle, Germany's public broadcaster, said exactly the same thing, that this is all a performance put on for Trump's benefit. Nothing of substance, nothing real achieved. There will presumably be another meeting. The Russians will go. Why shouldn't they? The Ukrainians very grudgingly will go, and the circus will go on. Probably not in Geneva. I don't think the Russians were keen. I don't think the Ukrainians were keen to meet anywhere at all. But anyway, sooner or later, presumably, it will revert to somewhere in the Middle East, though it might continue in Geneva, but no substantive progress was made. In the meantime, of course, the war goes on, and we are continuing to wait for the next big Russian missile strike. There's been quite a lot of discussion on the Russian side of the internet about the previous Russian strike, the one which was conducted by drones and KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles. And I've seen it suggested that one of the purposes of this attack was to track the movement of Ukraine's F-16 fighter jets. And Radovka, the Russian newspaper, which is published in Smolensk and which takes a very, very hardline view of the conflict. Anyway, Radovka said that the Russians now believe that Ukraine has only 10 operational F-16 fighter jets. All of the others have either been destroyed, or, given that they're very old aircraft, in chronic states of disrepair. And that the entire program to train Ukrainian pilots, as predicted by people like Brian Beletic, proved to be a complete failure, which explains why these fighter jets, these F-16s, are actually being flown by veteran pilots from the United States and by Dutch pilots, who, unlike the Americans, are not veterans and who've never actually seen combat, but who have just recent graduates from the Dutch flying schools. Just saying. Anyway, that could mean that the base areas where the F-16s operate from will be part of the next Russian target. The second Oreshnik strike that the Russians conducted on the facility in Lvov perhaps was partly intended to target F-16s, which might have been there in that facility. Anyway, we're all waiting for the next big strike. The rumours are that it's going to be focused again on Kiev, that Iskander ballistic missiles will mostly be used, And there continue to be worries that the Oreshnik might be used as well. In the meantime, the Russians continue to advance on the ground. Now, we've heard a huge amount about the Ukrainian Zaporozhye offensive over the last couple of days. At the moment, all reporting about it seems to have stopped, which leads me to think that it has run out of steam. In fact, in the area of Orekhov, it looks as if the Russians are continuing to advance westwards towards Orekhov itself. They've captured apparently another small settlement to the west, to the east of Orekhov. For the record, I believe that to the extent that there has been any interruption, any difficulties, any logistical difficulties experienced by the Russians in eastern Zaporozhye, it is due not so much to the presence, to the disconnection of Starlink. The Russian Defense Ministry, by the way, has now published a statement saying that the disconnection of Starlink has had no effect on Russian military communications whatsoever. And for the record, I'm sure that they are right, at least not in terms of the major military units on the battlefronts. But I suspect that whatever problems the Russians have been having with logistics are caused more by the fact that they have to transfer supplies across the Gaichur River in this area. And with all the bridges destroyed, they will have had to create pontoon bridges, and that takes time. And these bridges need protecting. And some of these bridges, at least in their early forms, are perhaps not the strongest bridges upon which to send large quantities of supplies across. It will probably take some time for the Russians to fully complete their logistical preparations in eastern Zaporozhye. But anyway, the big news is coming from Donbass. And Redovka yesterday said that the Russians are now storming Belitska, the town to the north of Rodinska, that they have established control over significant areas of Belitska. Belitska is quite a small place and geographically rather concentrated, but it is a town rather than a village, and a little bit like Stepnogorsk and Uglida. It consists mostly of large Soviet apartment style buildings, which take a lot of time to capture because they're natural fortresses. But anyway, supposedly, Belitska is now being stormed, and there are now numerous reports that appear to confirm that Ukrainian resistance in southwest Konstantinovka is indeed collapsing. That the supplies to the Ukrainian troops in southwest Konstantinovka have been interrupted now by Russian drone and missile strikes for several weeks, and that the Russians, as a result, have been able to penetrate into the center of Konstantinovka. And in a way, that makes Ukrainian control of this area of southwest Konstantinovka, which lies to the west of the river which bisects Konstantinovka, impossible. Now, the fall of this part of Konstantinovka would be decisive because this is again the area where all the high-rise buildings in Konstantinovka are apparently concentrated. So this is the main Ukrainian fortified area in Konstantinovka, just the southwest Pokrovsk was, just saying. And if it falls, then the rest of Konstantinovka will also fall very quickly. So anyway, that's the nature of the battle. There are Russian advances in other places, but these are the main battles taking place at the moment in Konstantinovka and in Belitska as well. So the war goes on, and we've had this extraordinary episode in Geneva. I would add that from what I can tell, the negotiations between the Americans and the Iranians didn't go especially well either. The Iranians are saying that the negotiations went forward in a good atmosphere, that all sorts of positive ideas were exchanged. But then the Iranians have an interest in keeping the negotiations going because they must hope, however forlorn that hope is, that if the negotiations continue, some kind of diplomacy might eventually develop out of them, which could avoid a war, which would be extremely difficult and hard for Iran. But again, I'm hearing all sorts of proposals which are apparently being discussed. The idea that Iran transfer part of its stockpile of enriched uranium to Russia, that a consortium be set up to enrich uranium partly in Ukraine in Iran, with Iran participating, but with other Arab states and perhaps the Russian agency Rosatom being involved as well. One hears all of these reports, but these were proposals that were made a year ago. They may seem sensible proposals, realistic ways out, but they are proposals which the Americans have consistently rejected. And the Iranians continue to say that they're not prepared to bargain on their ballistic missiles. Khamenei also said as much yesterday. He said that it made no sense for Iran to bargain away its ballistic missiles, because the ballistic missiles provided Iran's current deterrent. And if Iran were to give its ballistic missile capability away, it would lose its deterrent capability and open itself up for further attacks by a far more confident Israel. So that was what Khamenei said. Anyway, given that the Israelis and the Americans are insisting on restrictions, on limits on Iran's ballistic missiles, and given that the Iranians refuse to agree, again, I don't really see what the progress is. Going back to what I said at the start of my program, the fact that the Iranians are apparently intending or rehearsing the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, that strongly suggests to me that they quietly believe that war is definitely coming. Now, I'm going to finish this program today by returning to a topic that I briefly discussed yesterday. And that was the really very remarkable comments made by Putin's aide, Nikolai Patrushev, who was previously Secretary of Russia's Security Council, in other words, Putin's National Security Advisor. In fact, he's very, very long-running National Security advisor. And Patrushev retired from that role a few years ago, but retains a critically important role, or rather was transferred to a critically important role of building up Russia's shipbuilding industry. He is, by the way, by training, a naval architect, just to say, and supervising the development of Russia's fleet and naval fleet, and also of its merchant fleet as well. Anyway, Patrushev has again spoken about threats to the Russian merchant fleet. He said that there is active preparations now to try to blockade Russia, to close down, to stop Russia's external trade, that there are now plans to try to blockade Kaliningrad, this is by several NATO countries, and to try to block access for Russia to the Baltic, to the Baltic Sea. He said that the Western powers, if they embark on these dangerous plans, need to understand that the Russians will respond and will respond militarily. He also said, and it was very interesting, that if the Russians simply sat back and allowed the West from time to time to seize Russian merchant ships, then the pattern of escalation would inevitably intensify, and that eventually a complete blockade would be imposed. Many people have made this point in the past, that the Russians tend to be very slow to respond when the Western powers take aggressive steps against them, such as launching missile strikes against Russia, for example. And on this occasion, we have a very senior Russian official, indeed, one who has known Putin for a very, very long time and is known to be trusted by Putin and held in high regard by Putin, saying that on the question of the merchant ships, there can be no compromise. The Russians must act, and must act toughly, to protect their national security and economic interests by protecting their merchant fleet. And Patrushev went on to say that the Russian fleet stands ready to do that. And as I discussed briefly in my program yesterday, he hinted that other BRICS navies are likely to join in that as well. Now, I mentioned earlier in the program that I did wonder whether all of these tankers carrying Russian oil to China are intended to help build up Chinese oil stockpiles ahead of a possible closure of the Straits of Hormuz. If so, then the arrival of these ships in China, the continued supply of oil by Russia to China, is for China itself a national security interest. China now has, in terms of numbers, ship numbers, the biggest fleet in the world, war fleet in the world. And it also has three operational carriers, though only one of these is equivalent to an American supercarrier. But nonetheless, it is a big and very powerful fleet indeed. I wonder whether, in the event of a crisis, China might join with Russia to protect oil tankers transferring Russian oil from Russia to China. A year, two, 3 years ago, discussing such possibilities would have been unthinkable. But I don't think they any longer are. We are, as I've discussed in a recent programme, now looking at a potential superpower crisis. My sense is that neither the Chinese nor the Russians, even today, are looking for a conflict with the United States. But Russia doesn't want its energy exports blockaded. China doesn't want its energy and food imports blockaded, given that it is Russia that supplies China's food and energy imports to an increasing degree. One can see that there is now a commonality of interest between the two to protect them. Now, again, I don't want to speculate beyond the known facts, or at least not too far beyond the known facts. All I will say is that Patrushev did say what he did. And it is also true that the Russians and the Chinese are communicating with each other all the time, and that the Russian and Chinese navies now do conduct regular exercises together. So anyway, that is what I wanted to say about this. We are at an unusually dangerous moment. This I've said already, but perhaps it bears repeating. I can't help but think that if there had been a serious desire in the United States to find a way out of the Iranian conflict, the negotiations in Geneva would have been conducted in a completely different way. Marco Rubio, who is after all the Secretary of State, notice, is steering well clear of the negotiations in Geneva. He is not taking any role in them at all. So, to me, this bizarre circus in Geneva certainly points to a likely conflict before long in the Middle East. And as for Ukraine, here I do believe that the United States, for all the reasons that I've discussed many times, absolutely does want the Russians to stop. Its problem is not that it doesn't want the Russians to stop, it's that it doesn't have leverage to force the Russians to stop. And Ukraine, as I've discussed many times, has in the meantime become a strategic liability for the United States, and in particular a massive drain for supplies, in terms of supplies and weapons and all of that, which the United States can ill afford to continue to provide. But against that, the United States is still unwilling to force Ukraine into a compromise. It twisted the IMF's arm again the other day to get the United States, the IMF, to approve a further loan to Ukraine. The IMF's continuous lending to Ukraine, by the way, is a disgrace. Lending to Ukraine should have ended in 2015. It is obvious that the country is bankrupt and will never repay its loans. Its economy is devastated. Paying Ukraine loans, especially after Ukraine has defaulted on liabilities that it owes to Russia, a Paris Club member, is extraordinary. But it is what the IMF does. And as it is universally known, the United States controls the IMF. It is what the United States is getting the IMF to do. So I have to say, I don't take these negotiations seriously. I think that the circus we saw in Geneva will remain that. And both of these conflicts, the one in Iran and the one in Ukraine, are going to be decided on the battlefield. Anyway, that is my view. That is where I will finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Don't forget also to check our new Substack site. Please remember to support us via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.